kind of a bad Navi.
Yeah, kind of. But I mean, Navi is bad Navi, so.
That's okay. We're not getting into that.
Welcome to New Game Plus. You are listening to a retro gaming podcast where three guys spend 7 days playing one old game and then we talk about it. My name's Dustin.
My name's Kenny.
I'm Nolan.
And this is episode 145. Kenny, make a comment?
Yeah, 145.
That's the first comment. Adds nothing.
There was a question in our Discord this week asked by Jonadab, I believe, that I wanted to pose to you guys.
What?
What video game have you beaten the most number of times?
As in played the most times?
No.
Or like started the most? Literally gotten said, the victory condition.
You know that it's not either of those because no, I very specifically said beat.
Beat, which means you have played and which means you spent time with. So yes, beat.
He's like, do you mean look at? Or?
Do you mean 2 hour sessions or three?
Like there's a lot of games, some of the most replayable games tend not to have like victory conditions. Like, are we counting? I don't know.
Oh, so you're okay.
Well, so like playing Overwatch, for example, or maybe like competitive StarCraft wouldn't count,
right,
unless you were doing like the story of StarCraft or whatever.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So mine's kind of a one-off situation because I used to speedrun Link's Awakening DX,
right,
which is a Game Boy, a handheld Zelda on the Game Boy. And I've beaten it the most because I speedran it.
Right.
Yeah. But outside of that, maybe Ocarina of Time, probably.
Both Zeldas?
Yeah. And the third one would also be a Zelda.
Kenny, can you think?
That's a really hard question. I am thinking, but I'm trying to think accurately and give you a true answer.
Kenny, I feel like you're the kind of guy that beats a game once, though. And then
yeah, I don't tend to do a lot of like replaying of things. So I think it will probably be some kind of, I don't know, PC title that's like scope, but that you win. So
what about
maybe
those
like
games
one of the,
that you and Nolan played, like the dungeon things where
Diablo?
You do it again, like you beat it and then you beat it again and then you beat it
Diablo?
Again.
I almost wouldn't count that one too.
Yeah, I don't like Diablo. You're not playing the whole story. I mean, okay. If you're talking like from the start of the game to the end of the story, that might count, but most of those games, like you create a character,
just
run
a
the
single
in-game
player.
Content, and then just put it on farm.
Right.
Probably, maybe one of, well, no, I was going to say one of the Civilization titles, 5 or 6, but I don't think that's accurate. It's probably Super Mario 3.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I can see it.
And that's fair.
Like as a kid, you spam that game. That's the one that you would do
right.
Socially, and because of the whole flute thing, it was relatively short and beatable. And there's a lot of other games I've played significantly more than that. But in terms of a total count of like start a game, get the victory screen, I don't know that that would be number one, but it would probably be top five for sure.
When I was thinking about mine, I wondered if it was Super Mario World because that was my Super Mario 3. That's kind of like what I played over and over again as a kid.
Yeah.
And it might be. I also thought about Child of Light because that's the only game really that I've like tried to speedrun multiple times. And so and I love it. Like, and that's also the only game that as soon as I beat the game, I started a second playthrough. Like,
oh, yeah,
played
the
a
new
game
plus.
Plus.
Yeah.
Hey.
As an interesting anecdote, this is a really, really easy question if you were to ask my wife. Because just this week, she beat a game, like completely start to finished, got the victory screen, a video game for the first time in her entire life.
Tropical Freeze?
Yep, Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze. And she was so
That's
proud.
A good one.
I was a proud hubby.
That's awesome.
I don't think that Super Mario World or Child of Light or Tropical Freeze was mine. I think my answer would just be boring and predictable, which is Final Fantasy VII.
Final Fantasy VII?
Yeah,
I think that's
so.
My actual answer.
Yeah,
it's probably mine too.
That's not boring though. Like, that's kind of impressive.
I know, but I feel like that's my answer to every question. What's my favorite
game?
Final Fantasy VII.
That's true.
Final Fantasy.
Do individual chocobo races count as beating a game?
No.
Absolutely if so,
no. But I am so glad that games don't die the first time you beat them. Like, they can be resurrected absolutely. So that you have to have a second chance to defeat them. Which is near identical to the plot of our retro game of the week, Midi-Evil.
Overview. You still said it.
I don't know.
That's definitely how you pronounce
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, I think it's... I had recanted since and think that it's medieval. Yeah. I might say it a little bit more medieval just because I'm pretentious. But, like, it's clearly you say evil.
Medieval is an action-adventure hack-and-slash developed by SCE Cambridge Studio and published by Sony Computer Entertainment. It came out for the PlayStation 1 in 1998, and is called Midi-Evil because it's set in medieval times and there's evil in it.
Yeah, really, but really. We had some people on Twitter coming for our throats for pronouncing it that way.
We had Twitter, Discord, everybody coming at us this week.
That's funny.
This is one of those games I feel like we should know about, and I didn't.
I know, right?
Well, but I don't think okay. just us. I think, and we'll have to talk about it throughout the episode, but I don't. I mean, it wasn't a huge title. The
not
series
really,
continued.
No.
At least some people knew about it, but yeah.
It's all right.
The name is not spelled medieval. It's spelled Medi and then a capital E and, yeah. and then evil.
Right.
A portmanteau, too, if you will.
Is it, I is will. It PetSmart or PetSmart?
It's not smart.
The story of Medieval is centered around this undead Sir Daniel Fortescue. I told you Nolan, his name was Dan.
Fortescue.
Just funny.
Dead Man Dan.
So Dead Man Dan.
Yeah.
Huh. That should be the prequel. So the story here is that Dan, Sir Danny, led the king's army to defeat the evil sorcerer Zadok. And this battle commenced and he defeats the warlock, but is mortally wounded in the process. And many years later, Zadok, this evil sorcerer. Well, it's very, you don't know when you just look at this creature if it's a sorcerer or sorceress. It's very disturbing. But he's returned and resurrects his army, and in the process, unintentionally resurrects Dan, who now gets a chance at revenge.
Not now, just revenge, but redemption. Because ooh. You learn early on
right. that this is hilarious.
Story about Sir Daniel Fortescue being the epic hero isn't all it was cut up to be. In fact, this epic battle that he is now like considered the primary hero of, the first arrow that was shot in the battle kills him.
It hits him right in the eye. And so that's why he's missing one of his eyes, his left eye in the game, because the very first arrow takes him out and leaves him dead on the battlefield as the whole army runs forward to yeah. like to fight.
Can you imagine his army seeing that and being like, oh, well, you know, we're screwed.
Right. Like, which is funny because it gives you that full text of like, this is the story. And then immediately after you see the FMV, the full motion video where all of this, where the real story happens. And then all throughout the game, Dan is trying to like prove himself because he failed the first time. Like gargoyles and statues and the dead like spirits of the other fallen soldiers are all making fun of him the entire game. So like he really has to prove himself.
He does. And it's not a surprise that he's that guy because just as a character, like, and I don't think it's just because he's undead. Like he comes across as kind of like derpy. And he's real, like, gangly and sort of, I don't know, just the kind of guy that you would expect to not actually be a very good hero.
Well, and that's the kind of humor that you get here in this game, which is so, there's this clash, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but there's this clash of this lighthearted humor, but then there's this other like feel that you get the whole time. And maybe I thought it was maybe more so even than Nolan. We've talked about it a little, but I think you could think about Diablo when you think about this game. Hold on, guys, in the sense that it is like a hellish landscape, gothic overtones, morgue music is playing the whole time. So there's some of that same feel. There's like witches and all of these things. And so they're going hard in the paint on some of those tropes. But then they are like light, like doing the opposite with some of the humor. It's just this weird clash that some people might not think work, but and then some people might find very endearing.
I've always thought it works great. And to me, it's just that like that Tim Burton-y kind of dark, but funny, intentionally funny in the midst of it being dark. And they do it well.
There's two different types of like spooky themes, and there's that dark, like serious Diablo theme that you're talking about, and then there's this where it's like Halloween Town. So that's why I didn't get the like the same kind of like dark vibes that you might have.
Gameplay.
So I don't know about you guys, but the gameplay in this game reminds me so much of that PS1 era. I mean, this was on PS1, obviously, but like, just the way that you go through this game is completely PS1 nostalgia for me.
I thought so too.
But what do y'all mean? Like, what are some of the...
Okay. It's like...
Oh, okay. No. I know exactly what... It just clicked with me.
It's so clear.
Can I say what I think? Oh, and then you say like, yeah.
Yeah, go
so
ahead.
Like with some of these PlayStation games, whether we're talking about Crash Bandicoot or like Spyro or other things like that, you go from level to level and you've got some light puzzles within there, but you're taking out enemies. You're collecting something that lets you get to a new something, and then you get to the end of the stage. And then every once in a while, there's a boss, and that you just go from stage to stage that way. Is that kind of what
exactly,
you're saying? Like,
yeah,
absolutely.
Completely, yes.
It kind of reminds me of like Spyro, but a la Nightmare Before Christmas.
Like,
okay.
So what I'm saying is you have collectibles, and it like Banjo-Kazooie, you said that it reminds me a lot of that game in a way. This one's more linear than Banjo-Kazooie was. Like Banjo-Kazooie had an open like hub world. This has an overworld map, so it's a little different. But yeah, you're going through these levels and you're hacking and slashing and you're collecting things. And there are some light puzzles, nothing too intense. No Zelda-like puzzles where you really have to think about it, or at least I didn't. It was just kind of like... You do some light exploring, and it's very linear, and you have a terrible camera.
Exactly. It's light puzzles and light platforming. You know, like, every once in a while, there's light platforming, but the whole game isn't based on platforming. That's kind of how you're so right, that these successful PlayStation titles all have that same kind of feel and same kind of look in some ways. But I think at the same time, Medieval does... like some things so different, and you and I talked about it. So Nolan, you did a first play this week.
Yes, I did.
And then I streamed a little bit of my gameplay just because I've been on vacation, so I can do whatever I want. But some of the things that we noticed early on that were so unique is that on this one, like what you don't have in some of these other PlayStation 1 titles that are similar, is that you have different weapons that you can either purchase or find or
take off your body
or take off your body. So one of your starting weapons is your arm, like you can remove it throw it like a boomerang.
A
I loved when Nolan you started doing that and realized that it comes back to you.
Yeah, I was like, wait, what did I pick up? And then you see it says arm, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's a starting item, all right.
And so, like, that's just some of the things. I mean, we'll touch on some other things that make it unique. Spyro, like, we've talked about before, I have, and it's really kind of, like, stuck with me that for these early games, I either have to get character progression, like, your character has to get stronger or better, or the stages have to adapt and change and get better. I don't know if y'all remember those kinds of discussions. In this game, it's a little bit stages, but it's mainly your character. You feel like your character is progressing and that he's getting stronger because of the weapons, the upgrade, the health upgrades, all of these things that you're getting from stage to stage.
And even the kind of like overarching quest rewards. And some of those are linked and similar things, but you're not just progressing through the story and beating stages, but you're also on the hunt for these chalices. that are, again, sometimes part of the puzzle, sometimes earned different ways, but generally something you earn from just killing enough enemies within a level. But that kind of unlocks some of these rewards, and you even have some little side quests where you kind of find items and then use them later. And there's lots of sort of things to move forward to. Though the gameplay itself is a little repetitious, it avoids that because it takes you to different areas and lets your character grow in terms of, you know, items and such.
Yeah, and I think the way they handle progression is very straightforward and could be repetitious depending on who you ask, but I kind of really like it. So the way they built their levels, they built them around these runes that you find. So it's a collectible, it's a key. And you can't get, like, you'll come across a door pretty early in a stage that needs a rune. It's a little hand pedestal that's outside of a door, and it's like a keyhole, so you need to find this. And then you go find it and uncover some other things, and then you come back, and then you can access that room and get through the level. And it's like that for pretty much every stage. So, like, I kind of enjoy that simplicity and progression.
Yeah, I agree. And a nice smattering of, like, hidden stuff as well. You know, some optional things that if you fully explore and are taking the time to, you know, have the, to get the hammer or to have the club and to save it up and, you know, get behind the rocks and search on top of this thing or behind this place you didn't have to go. And that's always really rewarding. Like those are those little, ooh, you know, kind of moments.
That's a soundbite.
Well, and one of my favorite things about this, about all of that, from the quest to unlocking the doors to the light puzzles, is that it's story centric. Are you following me? Like, some of other games that we've mentioned are not really story-centric. It's just a new stage or a new area that you're doing some of the same things. And in this game, while you're doing some of the same things, you've got some differences throughout, but it's all, again, story-centric. So every side quest, you don't usually have side quests in these games.
No.
These side quests are optional, but if you do them, they're, again, I've said it, but it's story-centric, that it aids to what's going on in the story. There's a lot more story elements here in this game than some of those other titles we mentioned.
Yeah, there's lore and voice acting too, which is weird. But yeah, you do... That was also unexpected for me, because if I'm comparing this to some of the other PS1, like Spyro, Spyro has a little bit of that, but it's mostly just contained within, like, the theme and the charm. But in this one, they, like, actually went to the trouble of, like, building out some lore, some, like, funny lore, because the game is funny. And it just kind of makes progression feel a little more rewarding, like, when you have that story behind the gameplay. Because this is a genre that I always go to, not for any kind of story or progression, just for, like, platforming.
So we mentioned that you get some different kinds of weapons, but I think it's worth mentioning at least a few of what those are. Like,
Before we do that, it's in conjunction with that. But you had mentioned the chalices, right? Chalai. I think that it's important because that's how you get the majority of your weapons. So you kill a certain amount of enemies usually on a level that unlocks the chalice. Then a message comes on the screen, says the chalice is available to be found. You have to go locate it on the stage. Sometimes it's hidden. And then you collect that chalice, meaning that after you complete that stage, you are taken to the Hall of Heroes. It's kind of this bonus area. And what you do is bit by bit, you meet up with some of Dan's dead war buddies who are just statues.
Yeah.
Some of the people that were actually heroic and were in that battle and also died, but not terribly. Yeah.
And so they all give Dan a hard time for dying so early still throughout the whole time. Yeah. They're making fun of him, but they give him their weapons that they use. And so they've all got these unique characteristics. One is like this, like he's a metal worker or like I don't know, but he's big, burly, and he has a huge hammer.
Stainer.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
And he will then lend that huge war hammer to your character. Another one is like this little he's a half whore centaur, right? Is that what it is? Yeah,
I think so.
He lends his bow and arrow to Dan. And so, yeah, now that takes us into, so that's how you get these weapon upgrades. And then Kenny, sorry for interrupting you.
You're great. I think we wanted to talk about them. Let's see, you get a crossbow, you get some throwing knives, you get a series of like upgraded swords, you get this big hammer. You get a cool, like, throwing spear.
You get an upgraded shield as well.
Yeah, upgraded shield.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about the shield. Nolan, at first when you were just trying the buttons out, you're like, why do I have this pose?
It's literally, he was just squatting and he was like presenting like, ta-da. And I was like, why? And then you find a shield right after and then it's like, oh, well, why was that? Like,
because then it's a defense posture is what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But yeah, you get these different upgrades that really make you stronger. And the cool thing is it doesn't replace your other weapons. You can still always go back to those other weapons, but it does give you the option of using these other weapons, a lot of which have like limited ammo. So you heard that some of these things, crossbow, right, bow and arrow, those are ammo dependent, even throwing daggers. And so you have to – and you don't find those as drops, which you would typically do in some of these games. You have these stores located in various stages that are – what are they? They are greedy gargoyles.
They're little heads, yeah, gargoyle heads.
And you find them, and then you have to exchange some of your currency, your gold that you find throughout the levels, to purchase either some ammo or sometimes you can purchase like weak weapons like a club or different things like that.
Yeah. I think we should talk about some of the enemies because I think there's a surprising amount of enemy variety in this game, at least design-wise, maybe not in mechanics.
Yeah, mechanically they're pretty similar, but they run at you in a lot of different ways.
They run at you slowly or fastly, but but there are, there's different designs for sure.
Yeah, mostly you have your typical like horror trope. You have like zombies and like skeletons and stuff in the graveyards. And I wish that they would have had more of a challenge to them. The only thing, like, the only way I would get damaged is if my hitbox was just a little too close to theirs. You can literally just swing your hammer and hit anything. So I feel like that's one of the weaker points of gameplay is just how they went about combat. Because, like, yeah, the weapons are cool and everything, but when you really look at it, all you're doing is you're just swinging a different metal.
But isn't that hack and slash?
Not quite. I'd like to see a little more of like a strategy to how you handle enemies, even in a game like this.
You have your little like charge move.
Yeah, you've got a light attack and a heavy attack, and then you can charge that.
But see,
shield. You've got ranged stuff you can choose to use and turn off. I don't know.
I understand those are there. I was never tempted to use any of them. When you can spam swing, and in most cases, that's better than charging it for me. I would just do more damage quicker.
Well, for the first boss, like I think you have to use ranged weapons because his attack location or like the weakness, whatever, is a heart that he holds way above ground level. And so you have to use that. And some of the enemies later on, you have to use ranged weapons. But I agree with you. For the most part, you're just going to run at enemies. But then, I mean, it falls in line for me and then hack and slash them until they die.
I'm glad you brought up that first boss, especially. But
yeah, can we
the bosses in general, I loved their design for the most part. They didn't feel the same as each other.
Exactly.
They all kind of fit the themes of their levels really well and were unique and presented some kind of, you know, unique gameplay. And that first one especially lends itself to the kind of limitations of kind of the 3D, it being kind of polygonal, but it makes sense. It's this basically this stained glass window that comes to life.
And it's terrifying.
Oh,
it's terrifying.
It's a stained glass demon. It's terrifying.
It's huge, and it's got this pulsing heart in the middle of it, and it's all these multicolors and these angles. And, like, that's not a typical thing. Like, that's creative, and the fight, you had to really be moving. And once you picked up on it, it was pretty doable. But at the end of that fight, I was like, what a great boss. If they continue to deliver, you know, bosses like this, I'm going to be impressed.
Like, think Majora from Majora's Mask, the final boss. It looks like that, but a stained glass. It's really scary. So, like, that at that point in the game, I was like, okay, that's really dark. When before, I was just kind of like, I felt kiddy about it.
Right. Well, I felt dark from the beginning in some ways. But, Kenny, you mentioned it, and I just think it's key here because it's been one of my frustrations with some of these early games. It's your bosses here, there's not tons, which I appreciate, but they're different. They're not only stylistically, but they play different too. And you have to do something different to defeat them. And a lot of these earlier games that we've been playing, it's just all you do is the exact same thing to fight these bosses. They look differently, but they're the exact same. Thankfully, in Medieval, you have a few different bosses that operate differently and cause you, the player, to have to figure out how you're going to go about defeating this new sort of evil presence that you bring about in these levels.
Aged.
I mentioned it in gameplay, but for this era of gaming, it's not just PS1. It's any of those consoles. In 64 was also guilty of this, but like, you feel the nostalgia and that type of just that time in gaming, but it some of the things don't age well about it. And
you're starting us off bad, huh?
Yeah. I mentioned the camera, and I think we should talk about that.
Then let's do bad, and then we'll do good, because I think there's some great things that age.
No,
well,
yeah, I'm not saying there's not.
Starting with camera?
I'm starting with camera because it was a big issue for me.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm spoiled, though. Like, back in the day, I wouldn't have thought about it. So you use your right bumpers or your right triggers to turn the camera, but in a slow, resisting way. Like it doesn't want to look where you want to look. It's more so just like, no, use the D-pad and we'll change the camera for you.
Right. And I don't like that. Depending on obstacles, there's times that it just tells you no.
Yeah. Right. I just won't do it. And so,
but I think it's more responsive than some of these, like the more responsive than Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone that we played and some of these others.
Oh, there's some heavier offenders. Yeah, for sure.
It's going to be an issue again. You mentioned, I think that with these early PlayStation titles, the way that it just operates with this new 3D environment is they try to give you a camera that works, and you just often have issues with it, especially with the platforming areas. It makes it increasingly difficult.
Absolutely.
In this game.
This was developers learning to do 3D.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
And especially like a studio like this that was kind of off doing its own thing and made a game and got roped into this kind of, you know, big PlayStation project.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is it was kind of their first crack at it. And so considering that like transition and the whole development environment, I don't think we ended up with a terrible result, but it definitely is probably the single most obvious hiccup in playing this game today.
Yeah. Like I just think they were still figuring it out. Like they didn't know what cameras, if that was even a thought when they were developing games at the time. Like, what do you mean the camera? Like you're just looking at what you're playing. And then they realize like, oh, you kind of have to have a control over that.
Right. It's so weird to me now, like to put it in these terms, but nowadays with the two toggles, you know, you control your character with the left one and the camera with the right one. I never have put it into that phrasing, but that's kind of a unique thing. And during this time, you didn't have both of those. Did you for place? No, you didn't. You didn't. You just had the D-pad, right? Yeah.
Yes.
PlayStation 2 is when you had the two toggles, right?
Yep.
Okay. I hope we're
correct.
Right.
No, you're okay. Right. Just the one on PS1, yeah.
All right. I think also with that, I think using the ranged weapons proved difficult at times. The way that they had it set up was kind of creative in that there's a small little green, like kind of like, it's not a fairy, but it kind of reminded me of that. This little green like wisp that moves around the stage and it kind of automatically picks who you're aiming at, and you can't auto aim. You can't manually pick who you want to aim your weapon at, your ranged weapon at. And so I think that was, that also
it's
ages.
Kind of poorly. A bad Navi.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Navi is a bad Navi. So
that's okay. We're not getting into that because I fully disagree.
Hey, listen. Yeah. Oh, dang, I hit my freaking...
That's a whole nother episode on its own.
Hey, listen. A few good things. I think that it is absolutely stunning graphics for PlayStation. Nolan, you mentioned this when you were playing it. I mentioned it when I was playing it. Sure, it can be blocky at times, but I still think that it looks so good. And the cutscenes are amazing. There are too many of them at the beginning of the game. It takes a while to get into it.
Yeah.
But it looks like a Tim Burton movie. Mm-hmm. It is so well crafted, so well done. And I think that even in game, you know exactly what you're looking at. The colorization is great. The difference in level designs from castle to graveyard to like a ship, all of these things, I think that just graphically, this game excels so much for being a game that is what? Is that 20 years old now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
I agree. I think, like, it takes me back, but in a good way. Like, sure, there are hard angles and their polygons and stuff, but, like, the overworld was actually kind of pretty. Like, really detailed. Like, it looked like you were looking at a detailed map. And then, yeah, in the stages, I think what's important for me in these types of, when I return to these types of adventure games is like, can I tell what this is, what this room is trying to get me to do? And like, can I tell rooms apart or do they look all the same? And here, each room had its own unique look. The level design was actually like, you know, it kind of went along with that graphic, with the graphics, and just helped you progress in a natural way. I agree. And the cutscenes are crazy.
And one of the things that normally is a weakness here, I think because of intentionally clever design or maybe just sheer luck, but I think ended up working out well, is the your sprite, like your character. He is probably one of the blockiest, most kind of, you know, early 3D polygonal kinds of things that you see. Everything else, they can hide it a little better. But it totally works because of the characterization they give him. This big, goofy skull with these exposed, you know, giant teeth and no bottom jaw, just looking like a big, grinning derp. And then he runs around kind of derpy, but it fits his character. And so the fact that his arms and legs are the way that they are and are kind of, you know, like you can see the limbs moving and the whole thing, it feels undead, but it feels humorous, and it kind of forced them not to go like hyper realistic, and I think sort of masks the fact that main character can be really hard to do since they're moving around so much.
And you're talking about Dan, which like his the quirkiness of him, which kind of just brings me into another thing that I think aged well, and that is the sense of humor. Like,
For sure.
I thought that it was smart. It's jarring. The voice acting is intentionally silly and over the top. You just pass by right there, but Dan can't talk right because he apparently lost the lower part of his jaw.
It's so funny.
So the few words that he does say is just so muffled
out. Yeah.
And that's funny. Some of the, a lot of the characterization, even like the evil, scary Zadok, the sorcerer, is very disturbing,
yeah,
but
he's
also
ridiculous looking.
Has his kind of silly, hilarious moments. I think the humor ages well. I appreciate like the early 90s humor that we've seen in other games, but I don't know if it always ages exceptionally well.
Yeah.
But this isn't like stuck in a time period. I think it's smart, and I think it's something that is still funny.
I was being a little critical of it when I was playing the game because some of it was predictable, but when it clicked for me was, I don't know what stage, it's like the fourth or fifth one, and there's this giant mechanical representation of Zarok. I think it's Zarok, not Zadok, but like blocking your path, and it's like a robot, and you shoot its head off and you go through its legs, and then you see one of the little like monkey enemies controlling it from behind, like Wizard of Oz style. And it was just like, all right, that's pretty funny. Like, it actually made me laugh.
Nolan, I know we always go to you first. What'd you think of how this game sounded?
It was on brand with the theme and worked perfectly. I obviously with that, I don't have like a track that stood out, but it wasn't trying to do that. It wasn't trying to have a level that had like, you know, a look to it, and then a soundtrack that matched that in a way or something
it,
like that.
It was more atmosphere and less soundtracked.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gives me Danny Elfman vibes. It gives me like the early, like the Tim Burton Batman movie vibes. If you listen to it again, it's got that kind of same stuff. And it's interesting because like it's not an orchestra that recorded this. Like it's just all MIDI or whatever. And
yeah, yeah.
It's super impressive.
Putting the MIDI in medieval.
Nope. Nope.
So if you're really interested in this game, there is a sequel, Medieval 2, that came out in the year 2000. There's a reimagining of this first one called Medieval Resurrection that came out in 2005. And I don't know if you guys heard, but Sony recently announced a 4K remaster of Medieval for the PlayStation 4.
Nice. Oh, I'm down with that.
That's crazy.
Uh-huh.
I say that sometimes with these games. I'm like, I'd play a HD remaster of this. And then I don't because no one does make them. But, dude, great idea. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I just think that speaks to – it's a testament to its age. That if they can recreate it again, 4K, like in the year 2018-19, if that's what it's going to be, mm-hmm. and people will buy it and play it, then they did something right to begin with.
For sure.
Final thoughts.
At the end of each and every one of our episode, we determine whether or not our game gets our vote for New Game Plus status, which is just our general thumbs up or thumbs down. Do we encourage you to find a copy of this game and play it, or to reserve your retro gaming time for a different retro video game? And I'll go ahead and begin and just say that I think Medieval is a good representation of why the PlayStation was and is my favorite console. There are just so many games during this era that have heart and charm and that you can see that there was a team behind it that loved it and it wasn't just a cash grab. They're not planning it unfinished with tons of DLC and patches afterwards. They just created a finished package. And with that, it's imperfect and it's got its flaws. But I think this game looks good, sounds good, plays decent, but overall is a completely endearing package. And Medieval, like surprisingly, because I didn't know about it, but most certainly gets my vote for New Game Plus status.
Nice. I guess I'll go next. I think going into this, or after my first play is more like it, I tried my best to hate this game. I don't know why, because I did not like the main character at first. I didn't care for the Tim Burton ripoff. I liked that movie, but whatever. I just wasn't on board with the theme. I guess I just didn't feel like playing this game. But the more I played it, the more the charm and that like authenticity that you were talking about, Dustin, with developers put into it, just got to me. And like, I can't hate this game. It's too good. It's just where it lacks, it makes up for in humor and in like charm. I don't know. There's just something about it that reminds me so much of PlayStation 1 and just adventure games in general at that time. And I really miss single player experiences like this. And I'm really hoping that like, we'll get back to this after all this multiplayer stuff is done with and Fortnite and everything. But New Game Plus, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
That leaves you, Kenny.
Well, it's always nice when your opinion doesn't matter. But
as always.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't ever really. But I fully agree with you guys. And this is a New Game Plus title. For me, a lot of times I find my opinions of games changing throughout. You know, I'll like play it a little and get frustrated, and then you get into it and you're like, oh no, there's some good stuff here. Or it starts off great and then gets repetitious or boring. This game wasn't that for me at all. From the opening cutscenes and that kind of initial humor and presentation of the character, I fell in love with this big, derpy skeleton knight seeking redemption. I thought it was fun. And then the game was light. It wasn't too serious, but it was enjoyable, and they kept just enough things fresh to overcome some of the repetitious nature of this game. And I had a great time the whole time, start to finish, and it put a smile on my face. So, New Game Plus for sure.
I'm glad we all landed in the same place. I thought that I was going to have to fight for it this week just because I know it's probably not everyone's cup of tea, but I'm glad that we could all see the value in it, yeah. Which means Medieval is New Game Plus certified. Some of you wrote in this week to let us know what you thought about this PlayStation 1 title. Lucas wrote in and said, "This is one of those games that I come back to every year. I love the art style, the atmosphere, and the gorgeous music. I played it for the first time around 1999 or so. Neither me or any of my friends had a PlayStation, so we used to go to the local library, which had one and also a copy of this game. Nice. Kids would take turns playing the game, and I think we actually beat the entire thing this way. It's an extremely nostalgic game for me, and I'm pleasantly surprised to see NGP review it. Keep up the good work."
This is a fun one to be nostalgic about. Like, I kind of wish I would have played this at the time and been able to revisit it, you know?
Like, and what a story to play it with friends at the library.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's kind of cool.
I feel like whatever the game is, that's going to cause you to have huge nostalgia favor for it.
Oh, yeah. That's super fun. If it's like a Arthur title.
Even if it's, like so bad. Thanks for writing in, Lucas. Anthony also wrote in. He said, "First time writing into the show, and I felt it befitting since this is one of the first games I submitted for the Retro Master list."
Yeah.
It was like 2 years ago, guys. It's so great that it finally came up. He said, "I had such a great time playing as this was one of the first games that I've ever played on the PlayStation. It just brought back so many memories doing my best to progress through the levels, exploring as much as I can, all while staying up late. One of the things I found rewarding was being able to go to the Hall of Heroes after getting the Chalice to 100% and fallen heroes who stood by Daniel gave him their weapons to aid in his quest. This alone just made you want to do everything you can to fill the Chalice on each level, because after getting that first weapon, there's just so much curiosity and intrigue of what the next weapon is going to be and what the experience is going to be like once it is equipped. I'd give this game New Game Plus status since it is a fun action adventure game with a simple story along with some comedic moments thrown in and you just want to see it through. Although my frustrations were still there when an imp stole my sword and I had to make do without it until I could purchase a new one, but through all of that, this still brought back tons of nostalgia and it'll always be one of my favorite PlayStation titles. Hope you guys enjoyed it."
I will say, in general, from a game design perspective, I hate when enemies are allowed to steal your stuff. I hate
they
it.
They straight up steal it and run away with it.
Yeah, it's the worst idea. And then it's gone. And there's some games that's like punishing. They can steal stuff that's like important to the game. And I hate that. It's the worst thing. Anyways, I'll get off my soapbox.
Thanks for writing in, Anthony. And also for submitting this game. It was a lot of fun, so I'm glad I could experience it.
And you could always write in to ngppodcast@gmail.com, or you can submit a game to the Retro Master list. There are so many ways to do that. You can email us. You can hop in our Discord, and just there's a game suggestion channel there for you to submit games to. We'd love to add your games. We've got a Retro Master list, expansive list of well over 100 games, 15 years old or older, that we randomly select at the end of each and every episode, except this one.
Oh no.
What?
But do not fear. This is a good reason. So we have scheduled for our next episode our very next guest.
It's been a long time. I'm glad.
Yeah, it has. Like,
it's been over a year, but we us three don't just like video games. We like games. And this includes board games.
Oh yeah.
If Absolutely. You consider yourself a board game aficionado, then you most certainly know of our next guest. He is the founder of The Dice Tower, which is a network of video and audio podcasts dedicated to promoting board and card games. And although board games is his specialty, he is an all-around gaming enthusiast who has a love for old video games. And on top of that, he's got his very own Wikipedia page. That's a big deal.
You know we're going to get really off topic next week.
That's fine.
Because I've got to talk board game shop at least a little bit. I've got to get some recommendations, and I'm excited.
Well, who is it?
We'll definitely have a segment for that. It is Tom Vassell, and we are super excited to have him on the show. It's been a long time coming, and we're going to be talking about the game that he has picked out as this week's Retro Game of the Week.
I'm super excited. It's going to be fun.
All right, what What are we playing?
Final Fantasy Tactics.
Oh.
It's always a huge game when we have guests. They pick big ones.
I don't know if it's always a huge game. Remember that like car combat game Dan
did not give New Game Plus to? Yeah, I remember.
But yeah, Final Fantasy Tactics. That's so exciting. We played a couple of Final Fantasies. We played 7 and we've done one other. Have we done one?
Yeah.
So one and seven, maybe. But this is Final Fantasy Tactics, kind of an offshoot of those, and it's a strategy game. It's another PlayStation title, so that's two PlayStation titles in a row. I'm not complaining.
Interesting. I own this game. I have a physical copy, but I do not have a PlayStation 2 that works anymore.
Well, it's going to be so much fun to play this game this week. We'd love for you guys to play along. Find a copy of Final Fantasy Tactics, play along, and then at the end of the week, send us your thoughts, and we'd love to include your commentary as a part of our episode next week.
Speaking of commentary, we have a Discord where you can let us know your thoughts on games. There's a channel coming called a commentary channel. I have to speak with the board of directors before it gets put up, but join us in Discord, go to our Twitter, and click on the invite link. It's free.
We love to acknowledge our wonderful patrons who support us on Patreon.com. Every week, you guys help us continue to make a quality product. Most of the time. I've got to get used to a new routine of shouting out our 4 producer-level supporters. Zion, Bradley, Gimbarino, and Phil. You guys are the best.
Are the best. You sound like an Italian.
You
guys
are the best.
I sound like a voice actor from this game.
You can find us on our social media. That's Facebook and Twitter at NGP Podcast. You can find us on YouTube as well. That's New Game Plus Podcast. Listen to us directly on any podcast provider of your choice. Make sure you subscribe so that you are the first to get new NGP episodes. And while you're at it, it's a small thing, but it helps us out tremendously if you were to leave a kind rating and review.
5 stars or get out.
This episode was edited and produced by our good friend Tom Tate. Not to be confused with Tom Vassell, our guest next week. Make sure you tune in for that.
Tom Thumb, who is a completely different person altogether.
Join us next week as we play Final Fantasy Tactics. Until then, I'm still Tom.
I'm Kenny.
I'm salty that our small talk at the beginning wasn't Smash Ultimate News.
That is a long name. And this has been New Game Plus.
Smash character? Not news? Okay. Oh, that wasn't enough for you. Simon from Castlevania, playable character? That's interesting. Not enough. Richter from Castlevania, playable character?